Hello, you're very welcome to a brand new episode of F&I Rap Chat with myself, Paul Webster. It's been a while since I've been in this seat, but when I saw Ross Whittaker's new film a few weeks ago at a preview, I just couldn't wait to get him in here and discuss how he got it made. Beat the Lotto is in cinemas this weekend. I really recommend you trying to catch it in the cinema. The term cinematic documentary gets bandied around a little bit, and it can be a little bit like, oh, what does that actually mean? But when you watch this film, you definitely feel that it is a cinematic documentary. It fits the cinema screen so well. It's so immersive. The archive is great. It tells the story of a syndicate back in 92 who took on the Irish Lotto and decided that they could beat it. And it's a real kind of fun heist kind of caper. So it was great to sit down with Ross and listen to how he made it. There's lots of great advice there for documentary makers. And Ross has been on the show a few times before, so I think you can go back into the archives and find his backstory, but today we mainly focused on Beat the Lotto. So yeah, if you can get to see it, I really recommend it. Yeah, let's go to Ross Whittaker. Ross Whittaker, welcome to the studio. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
So we were just off air. We were just talking. You're in the middle of just doing a bit of running around and doing your publicity for your new documentary, Beat the Lotto, which I can't wait to dig into. So I was interested in what you were saying there about one of the great things about documentary is you kind of have a real thing to talk about, and like radio stations and press, they can grab onto it, so you're kind of enjoying that bit of it.
Yeah, and I think in this case we have a story that really works for kind of lighthearted radio, I suppose, and also it's the story in itself is fun, but also it kind of reflects a context that's was interesting in its own time, but is also interesting to look back at now. Like, if you've 1992 is when the story happened, it's 2025, so we're 33, actually it was the 33rd anniversary a few weeks ago, which I know is not a significant anniversary, but I found it amusing because it's very hard to say, but for an Irish person. But you often find that if you look at a story from a remove of 20 or 30 years, you can really see where it falls within society, national identity, and all those kinds of things, which is fun. So all those elements in docs often make them, I suppose, good for media to talk about.
So I think I remember you talking about this project probably 8 years ago or so.
The first email I sent was 2013, and it's almost like when I think about it, it was a different person that started this project because so much time has passed, you know. But would I start it again today? I probably would. You know, you don't come across that many stories that have the elements that this story has. And like, I'm 100% committed to making documentaries as opposed to any other sort of cinema or, video work or whatever it might be. So like, you don't get many documentaries that have all the elements that this story has.
Yeah. Well, what was it when, take us back to when you first heard it, and then that sometimes when we find these stories, we might think it's something, and it turns out not to be. What was that process with this story?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one because like the minute I heard it, and we're on a kind of filmmaking podcast here, so maybe you can go into more depth than you can elsewhere. But at the time, I had been doing a lot of observational work, and that's like my true love is, you know, spending time following people around and stuff like that. But there are other types of documentaries, and I wanted to test my proficiency or develop my ability in more than one element of documentary, which of course, like, documentaries are endlessly flexible and just, you know, any number of genres within what some people call like the documentary genre. But with this, I suppose I was looking as a someone that likes to make films for something that would help me to develop a different part of my filmmaking skill set. So I was specifically looking at the time for a story that had been made, or that had happened maybe a couple of decades earlier. So you had that context of time. You know, you could look at it and look at Ireland at the time, or look at the world at the time from the remove of a different place almost, you know, essentially a different time and place. But also, you know, had a clear beginning, middle and end. You could see it, you know, okay, that's the narrative. Had living people that could tell the story well, and had archive that you could use to work with. So like I actually had sort of come up with this idea in my head. I'd like to find a story like that. And I was at a wedding, and a friend of a friend, or a guy called Brian Carter, a really nice fella, and I were chatting away, and he said to me, you should make a documentary about this story. And immediately the light bulb went off, because I remembered the story really well. I was a small kid at the time, but I remembered it being really fascinating to me even then, and immediately had all those elements, you know, and had as well like humour and heart and an Irishness to it, but also something that people could probably enjoy anywhere. And I just thought, okay, I have to try and make this.
Brilliant. The difference, you touched on it there, there's such power in the kind of unfolding story. And that's, you know, that you kind of, as you said, that's kind of more your bread and butter. What were the things, what were the big challenges that maybe came up with this? As I've had the same where, there's a natural thing to an unfolding story. You just kind of have to follow it. It's more straightforward in a certain way, but when it's retrospectively, were there any kind of big challenges that came up with that format?
Yeah, it's kind of the same but different, isn't it? So you're kind of, you're still trying to tell an unfolding story. It's just that it's already happened. I think what's tricky about it is finding what to leave out. And it's always the case, I suppose, with factual material, you know, you don't want to take so much out that it changes the story fundamentally, because, you know, your biggest responsibility is to be truthful. So I think that's kind of the trickiest thing. And you don't want to feel as well. And maybe I, at times, you know, I worked with a great editor, Nathan Nugent, and we didn't have this specific conversation, but at times I felt like he was pushing me in a really good direction, which is like, don't lean too much into the heist tropes or and stuff like that, you know, and actually remember to kind of look at what you have in the material and embrace the spontaneity or the unusual things about it, you know. So I felt like that was probably what I found challenging, is you kind of have a heist story, you almost are moved to just make it as a heist film, you know, but actually you want to be able to like digress and just getting that balance right, I suppose. You don't want to go so far from, I suppose, the exciting part of the narrative that it drags too much either. Like, hopefully people are coming to see an exciting story. So getting that balance right, I suppose, was the tricky bit. And that was like working with Nathan very closely on those kinds of conversations to find what we hope, I suppose, is the right balance.
The great Nathan Nugent, I assume he was kind of familiar from his Reeling in the Years.
Yeah, I wonder, actually. I don't think I ever asked him, did he specifically know the story? But like, he's a master with archive and music and so on. Like, we had some really good conversations. And like, there's a wider team. Like, it was probably the most collaborative thing I made. Like, Aideen O'Sullivan, that works for me a lot, was producing. Alex Sapienza shot it. Like, and these conversations were happening between all of us, and Michael Fleming, the composer, as well. It's kind of like trying to get all of those balances right. And Nathan, yeah, I mean, Nathan's great with music in that, like, at times, you know, one of the things he was saying is like, the music should reflect the characters as well. Like, not just that it feels like you need a track. Like, there was a portion of the film where I really wanted a track to kind of like take off and bring us like strongly through a section. And he said, like, the guys in this film wouldn't listen to that piece of music. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. Like, it, you know, if you want everything to sort of work together, you have to sort of think about some of these things. And I, you know, I've thought about, I've been obsessed with documentary making for years, and I've probably thought about a lot of things, but that was something I hadn't really specifically thought about. Yeah. And so then the music we used, as well as having like, you know, cinematic music, like, you know, when we're looking at some tracks to include and stuff like that, it was like, would the guys actually, could you as an audience imagine the characters like listening to something like this? Yeah. And it reflects them much better then.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great kind of tidbit just to have, yeah, in your pocket kind of thing. Because sometimes tone can be so hard, like, can be, especially with documentary. I think in drama, it's a bit more built in, but it's something that you have to find. Was that something And especially when you've got something that's kind of across genres, there's the heist element to it, kind of fast paced, but then a lot of humor. Do you ever have a thing like where maybe this can be too funny, or, you know, because I think that balance seems to be great. There's really funny characters in your doc.
Well, you are reliant on what the people say, and like, I would never, it sounds weird like in a way, but I wouldn't be trying to be like funny, but if they are funny, then great, you know what I mean? So like, it's, and you can, I suppose, feel like it makes sense for them to say something funny at this juncture, and obviously like the editor, like Nathan in this case, but all the other good editors I've worked with would play a big part in that timing as well. But like, for me, tone is just huge, you know, and I just think one of the things I try to do, I suppose, is be really careful with rough cuts and stuff like that, that you don't start leaning into tone because you've used a certain type of temporary music, or, you know, to always try and remember, and like, you've kind of worked this out on paper, like, where do you want the audience to be at this point? And then, so how do you edit that sequence? What kind of music do you use, if any, in there to get that tone right? Because sometimes in the editing process, you can be in danger of getting lost because you've just started editing in a certain way, or you've, your first idea for that, it looks like it's working. But often when you take a step back and you're trying to do longer work that's over 60 minutes or 70 or 80 minutes, all that stuff is just so important, you know, that the tone is consistent or the tone's in the right place vis-a-vis the story. So that's something I suppose I would think a lot about. And often I like to encourage editors, not that I could ever really tell Nathan what to do, but like, to cut sequences without music, you know, and actually then, like, you know, get the story of the sequence. And there's so many more layers to it after that. But like, when you look at the story of the sequence, like, what is that telling you about the characters and about where you are in the film tonally? And then edit it and use music on that basis, as opposed to sort of like throwing it all together and then going, oh, that kind of feels right. Often, if you do it that way, it's not right.
Yeah. When you were pitching this, how did you pitch it?
Well, it went really badly. I obviously didn't pitch it that well because everyone in Ireland turned me down. So, it was a very, I mean, I'm amazed now when I think back, because as I've already alluded to, I think the story has everything, you know, and, but sometimes, you know, it's complicated how we get funding. And, you know, it's like, and anyone that, I mean, I don't know about someone like Lenny Abramson or someone like that, but most people have been turned down way more times than they've ever had success, you know? So like, you get used to it and you just keep trucking on. But in this case, I think, you know, when you're pitching it to a particular funding entity, there's all sorts of reasons why you can be turned down. And sometimes it's nothing to do with what you're pitching, or it could be more to be with how you're pitching it, or the timing, or what else you're bringing to the table in terms of financiers. Like, I mean, I think, say with Screen Ireland, you know, who did in the end support this film, and I'm hugely thankful for their support, and generally we're so lucky to have them. You know, I think it's really helpful for them if you can show that the film will travel beyond Ireland, and that can be, you know, that you can show that funders from other countries have shown some interest. Like, that can really help you. But when you're telling a story that's very Irish, or that's kind of, sometimes it's harder for funders from other countries when they're looking at documentaries to think, you know, that this is going to play to their audience. You know, it can be different with drama, I think, and I think it would be tricky with docs. So that's the difficulty, say, sometimes with Screen Ireland. For then with RTE, you know, again, who makes so much great stuff, feature docs can be challenging. So, you know, so sometimes that's a reason for them not to want to do it. And then with Commissioner Naman, who have been the BAI and the BCI, they've probably gone through three names since I started this project. But for them, you know, it really is about ensuring that you adhere, or that you really fit their scheme, you know. And sometimes you can write a great proposal, but if it's not, and I hesitate to use the words tick in the box, because I don't think it's as kind of bureaucratic as that. But, you know, you have to be speaking to their scheme. So, you know, you can make the smallest of mistakes and end up nowhere. Like, that's, and I think to a certain extent, maybe that's what happened with this for a while.
When you were, I suppose, getting your crew on board and getting them, like, did you use mood boards? Did you, what were your kind of references to kind of get people on the same page?
I think not mood boards and stuff like that, but I think with Alex that shot it, like, I think we'd done a few things together before, and you know, we probably had been talking about this doc for years actually, and you know, there's a few things we'd done before that were, you know, not the same as this, but may not have been too many steps away. So we'd probably developed a little bit of an idea in our head of the kind of how we wanted to do things, you know. So that probably happened in a much more, in a less sort of specific way, and just evolved over time. Yeah, and then like actually we shot it during lockdown, all the drama, well, not rehab dramatizations as such, but all of kind of the macro shots and all the other little kind of shots that we did to try and tell the story visually. So it actually did quite limit what we were able to do. I'd love to shoot a lot of it again, frankly, but we are. But yeah, so I think, you know, those factors all sort of informed it in a way that maybe, you know, if I was starting again now, I might sort of approach it differently with, as you say, mood boards and so on and so forth. But I guess it was a sense of trying to have a sense of the stuff we shot reflecting as much as we could the time that the story happened in and the people that were in it, you know, and sort of looking at the archive as much as anything and kind of getting a feel for what, you know, what the characters were at the time broadly and so on and so forth, and trying to reflect that.
I read that initially you wanted to kind of show both sides or have,
yeah.
So you have the guys from the syndicate who take on the Lotto, and then you wanted to show the Lotto, hopefully get the Lotto guys and the big character Ray. I think he didn't want to do it. To me now, it seems hard to imagine, or like, I think it works so well as it turned out. So was that just like a case of kind of rolling with that and then adapting? How do you feel about that now?
Yeah, and actually that's funny, you know, because we were just talking about the funding, because, you know, when I first pitched it, that was very much what I was pitching, a two-side story. And I suppose then when it came around, there was a point, I suppose, where it looked like we may have both sides, and that's what we were pitching at that point. And then when that wasn't happening, it sort of changed the conversation around the film. Oh, they're not quite getting what they want, and maybe that was caused a bit of trouble or in the funding aspects of it, you know. So yeah, you know, that's what I wanted to do, and I had this sort of version of it in my head, and I sometimes think, like, trust your memories and your instincts to a degree in terms of how they felt more than like the specific factual elements of them. But like at the time, and if you look at the archive, like a lot of people felt like what the syndicate were doing was wrong, and there was almost like, you know, grubbiness to it, almost like, or, you know, like something that felt a little bit on the, like, the dark side of the force, shall we say, for Star Wars fans. But so, you know, I kind of had an idea that, you know, if you drew a moral line, that the syndicate might be on one side of it and the lottery might be a little bit on the other side. And that would give us sort of visual potential as well for everything that we shot. You know, the syndicate side might look a little bit different to the lottery side when you're doing syndicate interviews. You know, they might look a certain way. The lottery dramatizations might look a bit. You know, you see, to me, like, there was a lot of scope in that was really interesting. Like, it's funny, as you say, like, I can't really imagine what it would have been like now, you know. And, you know, we've got 80 minutes that feels like completely packed. If you added another one, two, three characters into that,
yeah,
you know, is it still, you know, how does that even work, you know? So in a way, it worked in our favor, I suppose. I still would love to have had people from the National Lottery of the time in it. I know, like, I was talking to Nathan the other day, and he said, you know, if Ray agreed to do an interview now, I'd recut the film. You know, I was like, I don't know what that would look like. He said, don't worry, I'd make it work. But so, like, it is something, you know, and we love Ray because, like, he's such a brilliant character. But, you know, he's still there so much in the archive that, yeah, I think we portray him as he is and so on. And kind of exclusive for you is that Ray has actually seen the film as, okay, well. So that was interesting. You know, we showed him the film just because I felt like if he's going to be in the film in archive, then he should know what's in it, you know, and yeah, so on. So I won't say too much about that because I don't want to betray any confidences, but, yeah, you know, we did show him the film and you know, so I didn't ask him after that, if, would he consider now being in it? Because I didn't think that would be fair, but
he was happy.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I mean, I think he appreciated the amount of work we put into it, maybe as much as anything.
Yeah, I suppose you were lucky that there was so much who knew? Like, kind of, I don't remember the incident, but just that there was so much of him. Yeah,
if you're even born, I don't
know. No, I was. Yeah, I was 5 or 6 or something. Yeah, yeah. But that, you know, that he was such a public figure.
Yeah,
so much archive.
I hadn't remembered that at all, like that aspect of it. And I suppose in the development period, we did a good archive trawl. So that, you know, we discovered in that development period, we'd applied to Screen Ireland, who were the Irish Film Board at the time, because it was a long time ago. And we got some development money and we put that into interviewing Stefan and getting all as much of the archive as we could to have a look at. So, and then we cut a promo from his interview and the archive. So we knew quite early on there's some really good stuff there. And the promo, which was, let's say, 4 or 5 minutes at the time, like if you look at the trailer now, they're not even a million miles away from each other. Like it's a lot of the same material that stands out, you know, even then and now. So that's interesting, you know, like I guess we could see immediately there was material there. I suppose like you always wonder, will the material sustain the entire duration? Like, you know, it's one thing having enough material to make a great 5 minute promo. It's another thing, do you have enough for 80 minutes or 90 minutes or however long your film's going to be? So, So anyway, there was great stuff. And I suppose there's a couple of reasons. Like one is the lottery was such a exciting thing at the time. Everyone wanted to talk about it. You know, people were winning prizes left, right and center. It was always a good news story. Like there was, so from that point of view, there was a lot of footage. I mean, it was all news footage and I love taking news footage and kind of repurposing it into stories. And then as it happened, thankfully, in the 3 days that this story unfolds, Mark Little, who was went on to be a presenter at Primetime and created Storyful and all these kinds of things, very bright and successful man. He was a Cub reporter at the time and you couldn't have asked for anyone better to be put on that story because he was out there getting the story and he understood the tone of it, you know, himself at the time, instinctively. So it meant that there was sort of 3 days of someone trying to follow them around as much as he could.
That's really interesting because I was just about to say that one of my pet peeves in docs is kind of throwing in random journalists who maybe are there to give context to the time but don't really, you know, weren't there or weren't maybe even covering. But one thing that really stood out was that weaving through of those journalistic voices. But they all really seemed to have such vivid, clear memories. So I thought that was really well done. And also, like, to touch on the kind of Pat Kenny, again, like you could kind of, you could imagine a doc where Pat Kenny's kind of thrown in there. You know, there is that famous archive of him on the Kenny show, but he really did seem to have this like fondness for the story and really did actually seem to be part of the story as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible the extent to which the story interacts with Pat's journalism and broadcasting career, you know, from, you know, you want to portray, and, you know, you don't want to spend too long on it, but it's important context, you know, the time that we were in. And of course, he was a Today Tonight presenter, which was the current affairs show at the time. Then he had his light entertainment show. And you know, because his show was on a Saturday night, the climax of the draw on a Saturday night was always announced on his show. So like there was a natural connection between him and the lottery at the time. Not only that, it's not in the film, but Pat and Ray were in school together. Throughout junior school, throughout primary school. So he knew Ray and he knew him very well. So like in a way, Pat wasn't quite a proxy for Ray, but he knew Ray and he knew Ray's personality. So like when Pat says, you know, a few things about Ray, you know, we didn't have time to go into that connection, but like I felt happy that, you know, he knew enough about Ray that if he said Ray felt a certain way or Ray may have acted for a certain reason, then, you know, a certain amount of confidence that that was pretty accurate. So as much as you can, I suppose, you know, but I have the same pet peeve of just journalists randomly being put in to, as a narration device, you know, like having said that, I don't know if I've ever directly done it, but like, you know, not far off at times, but like, you know, even you want the journalist to have covered that to an extent or like largely because then they're actually speaking to it from a position of behind the scenes knowledge. In the case of Beat the Lotto, Mark is in the story. Pat's in the story. Lise Hand wrote articles about it at the time. She actually had a brilliant article about like the day you know, that they got the money. We it was sort of the story had already ended in the documentary before that we would have got to that article, but it was great, like, you know, and even the guys remember sitting in a pub talking about it and talking to a woman beside them, and the next day seeing in the paper and that person was Lee's hand, and they hadn't, they're fully cottoned on, and I don't think she had done anything untoward, but just, you know, the way people are, hadn't fully cottoned on that they were speaking to a reporter. I'm sure she had made it pretty clear, but they may have had a few pints on board at that point. Anyway, I don't know if if I'm reflecting that part of the story all that well, but yeah, so, I mean, I think the big thing for me is, like, you want the story to come from people in the story, and if there's going to be media in it, then that should be the case. And in this case, it became such a media story that that worked out quite well.
So there's a lot of talk. I mean, the industry is so much in flux, and we kind of touched this on this off air.
It's always in flux.
Always
Paul.
In flux. Yeah,
you know, there's a lot of flux.
Yeah. Well, it was such a refreshing experience to go into the cinema and watch this and be totally immersed in it. And like, if ever there was a documentary that earned the title or the description of cinematic documentary, it's this. So I just wanted to congratulate you on the success of it.
No success yet, Paul. It's not even out yet.
Yeah.
Hopefully there will be some.
In terms of the success of making it. But yeah, hopefully that will translate.
Thanks.
I would love to get your thoughts on where documentary is at this moment.
Well, look, I think it's always been tricky, you know, and it's never been a place where there's a lot of money, you know, and of course people are aware that there are documentaries made from, you know, zero budgets to a few million budgets, but most of them are closer to the zero than they are to the 3 million. So I think nobody got into making documentaries to get rich. So like and that's not what this conversation is about, but I'm just trying to make the point that there's never been a lot of money in making documentaries. So firstly, most people go into it because they have a passion for people or a passion for factual storytelling. They love watching feature docs, whatever it might be. So I think, like, as well, like, expectations is a big part of it. So like, we don't expect as documentary makers for it to ever be, you know, awash with funding and opportunities. Like, it's always, there always has been and always will be a battling element to this job. So it still is like that. I think, you know, it's an interesting thing in that we hear a lot of noises, you know, and this is out there a lot. So hopefully if I'm saying this, it's fair to say that I feel like we hear a lot about things not going really well in the UK in the documentary and drama sector at the moment. But I think that's a little bit different to here. I think they've had a real streaming boom that didn't touch on Ireland as much, shall we say, just because I think the size of the country and population and so on and so forth. So I feel like things are largely the same in terms of how they pretty much have always been. The only thing is that we have more and more people who want to make docs and more people who want to get into making docs. And the competition for what funding there is really, really strong. So I think the emphasis that I suppose people need to realize is that if you want to make something, it has to be bold and it has to be, you know, not quite audacious, but, you know, maybe audacious, but like you have to find your voice and all those kinds of things. And hopefully the best stories and the most determined and skillful people will get to make their films. But yeah, there's never been enough to go around in documentary, and there definitely isn't now. And as I said, I think the competition is getting stronger. Like, going back a bit, if you want to, like, in 2007, I made a feature doc, and it was the first one the Screen Ireland had done, I think, in 5 years, because there was a new person head of the film board at the time, Simon was his name, and a guy called Alan Marr was sort of taking over looking at documentaries and trying to kind of get feature docs going. And so back then there was none, do you know what I mean? And now we've got 20 a year, say. Now most people are probably earning minimum wage making them, but there are feature docs being made. And yeah, I'm sort of losing my train of thought, so feel free to jump in.
Well, the final question, you mentioned that the person who started out on this journey in 2013 is a different person. which is often the case, and that is the thing with these things taking so long. But if you could have a chat with that person now and give them advice.
Wow, well, you know, probably like, you know, get a different job. I'd say you still got hope back then, 12 years ago. So, yeah, you know, it's, I love this story and I love making it, so I wouldn't change anything about that. I think I've learned a lot in those 12 years, I guess, about how to, you know, one, how to make projects, but also, like, I suppose, how to try and get them up and running. So I feel like I've learned a lot in that time. But, you know, I suppose this is terrible, but I would say, like, it never gets easier. You know what I mean? That's the one thing you'd say to yourself, like, don't expect it to get any easier, because you'll always, every time you start a project, you're starting from scratch. I mean, the one thing I guess people notice, it doesn't come naturally to me, but, like, getting to know the people in organizations, like, you know, if this is a conversation about how you get your stuff made, it's getting to know the people in those organizations and never stop making stuff. Then is the other side of it. Like, if you want to make documentaries, you have to find a way of making them. And it's only through doing that that you develop your skills and maybe start to show people that you can safely take a project from an idea all the way to conclusion and do it in a, you know, ideally in a fantastic way, but at least in a half decent way and in a professional way. So, but yeah, I mean, not a whole lot has changed in that time in some ways. But, you know, the more you do, the more you learn about how to do it, for sure.